Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How do we conceptualize the vast world that surrounds us, and what sort of power is attached to the ability to document and navigate that world? Maps are such a common feature of everyday life that we largely take for granted the ability to know what lies beyond the range of our own eyes. But as my guest today discovered by tracing the history of map making, this remarkable technology has not only had an enormous impact on politics, commerce, and society, but may indeed have been one of the first indicators that human brains had evolved well beyond those of our lower primate ancestors. The new book by author Simon Garfield is called On the Map, A Mind-Expanding Exploration of the Way the World Looks. Simon, welcome back to Think.
Hi, Chris. Nice to be joining you.
You write that maps begin as a challenge of the imagination. What do you mean by that?
Well, really, you know, 2,000 years ago, a little bit more than that, I imagine how hard it would have been to figure out our place in the world and how the world looked. And yet, this is what, you know, the librarians at the Great Library of Alexandria managed to do. They commissioned from travelers who came into Alexandria, from navigators, and they got it from really trying to figure out what they could from the heavens as well. And a certain amount of guesswork. They managed to piece together three continents in the world. We know that this wasn't the complete map, but three continents wasn't something like 2,000. They knew about Asia, they knew about Europe, and they knew about Africa. And they placed them pretty much as we place them today. That era is an actual map. We don't actually have an existing map, but we have what amounts to the back of an atlas without the map. So we have the cities and we have the coordinates and we have things based pretty much on scientific principles as well. And we were able, I think, in Victorian times to sort of reconstruct a map that we think knew about the world 2,000 years ago. So it was their imagination then. It was our imagination in Victorian times.
What evidence do we have of the very earliest attempts to make visual representations of the larger world, if not specifically maps that would look like maps today, maybe things like hunting locations and plans for some sort of collaborative effort along that line?
Yeah, well, you mentioned, you know, that sort of maps sort of play a part in the development of our brains, and the thinking behind that, which is backed up by people like Richard Dawkins, is that the hunter gatherers on the African plains, we didn't yet have the language to communicate how we survive. And it's thought that maps existed before language. And the reason we know that is because we have found, you know, maps on caves that predate language. And it's the obvious thing to do. So, you know, if you want to gather a team of hunters to show where the juicy elk is to be hunted down, you would draw a map in the sand or a map in the dirt, and you would put a mark where we were or where you were, and you would put a map where the elk was, and you would maybe put in some other symbols about how to creep up on that elk carrying your spears. So those were the ancient ways of getting about, and it's thought very much that it was through this that our minds and our brains grew, and this is thought to be the kind of crucial factor that enabled us to make the leap from sapiens.
How did the earliest map makers, beyond the time of prehistoric man, how did they try to calculate the relative size of particular land masses and bodies of water? How did that technology evolve?
Actually, not a million miles from me that we do it now, really. GPS relies fundamentally on a system of triangulation. And in ancient Greece, it was a similar thing. I mean, navigators guided themselves very much looking up at the heavens. But the way that these things were mapped was initially, again, you know, we go back to ancient Greece, and it was the use of a triangle using the sun and a pole and where the shadow fell from the sun. And through that, through a fairly complicated mathematical program, they were able to work out such things as the circumference of the Earth. But in terms of where things lay in relation to other things, we relied very much on travelers' tales about how long it took. So they knew that, you know, to get to a certain island, it would take this amount of time. And if they applied that to another landmass, they could say it was that kind of size. So it was a mixture, I suppose, of mathematics, heavenly science, celestial science, and personal anecdotes from those who had actually sailed around these lands.
It's really interesting to imagine what it must have been like to cross the ocean without absolutely being sure not only what was ahead, but how long one would have to travel before reaching land again. And am I right that the early European explorers were still working with Ptolemy's rather outdated calculations regarding the size of the planet itself?
Yeah, I mean, this is why, you know, Columbus, amongst others, got so much wrong. They were, you know, he was trying to get to the east, and he ended up, as we know, in South America. I mean, we have to be quite careful, really, in saying that we got a lot wrong, because obviously we got a lot right as well. You know, I mentioned the sort of the three continents, but You're right. That there was a huge gap between ancient Greece and the maps of Ptolemy from 100, 150 years BC. And then what happened was that although the map making tradition extended into Asia, although our records of that are scant, in the West, and especially in Europe, map-making to a certain extent fell into the sort of the cartographical Dark Age. And what we had instead was religious maps and fearful maps and maps that weren't awfully concerned with accuracy and geographical correctness. What they were concerned with more was, you know, how to live your life in a good sort of moral, God-fearing way. So, for instance, I talk in the book about the Mappa Mundi at Hereford Cathedral, which is one of the oldest and greatest surviving world maps that was drawn on the back of a calf skin, and it's about sort of 5 foot in diameter. And in the middle of that is Jerusalem, and that's what was important. Now, Jerusalem, as we know, doesn't actually lie necessarily in the middle of the world, but it was in the middle of their world. If you were religious, if you were a pilgrim, that was the all. And then the map had not only sort of fantastic mythical creatures on it and tales from the Bible, but it, you know, it had heaven and hell, and it told tales. And that's what maps were important for hundreds of years, until, as you say, Ptolemaic maps, Claudius Ptolemy's maps, were revived again. Essentially in the 15th century, and these were the ones very much that were used and updated when Columbus and other great explorers began their golden age of exploration.
Simon, when maps would picture bodies of water and have huge sea serpents or say, here be dragons in really sort of scary lettering, did people actually believe those fanciful creatures existed, or was this something that was really more a representation of the unknown?
Well, it was two things, really. One, there's no question, a sailor out on the dark seas with hardly any maps to guide you and with no real indication of what you were going to encounter, and you saw some fantastic beasts out there, you would be scared, and you would make note of this as well, perhaps as a way to kind of, to appease your fear. You would draw these fantastical beasts, and maybe, as one does in a pub after a few drinks, these beasts would get larger and more more fearsome. But the other thing as well is that traditionally, map makers really don't like gaps on their maps at all. So if you've got huge areas of sea, it's kind of dull, really. If you're trying to sell a map in particular, it's not the most interesting thing just to look at blank space. So they would put these things in to make them more attractive as well. But the key point in all of this is that, we have this fantastic phrase that we use all the time, here be dragons. And what that is very much is a way of us saying, be careful, these are kind of dangerous waters that we're about to enter here. And it could be used in a sort of metaphorical sense as well. Interestingly enough, the phrase, which we assume appeared on, medieval maps, ancient maps, never did actually appear. So I would be very happy for all your Texan listeners to... I will award a prize if anyone can point out an old map. It can't be a reproduction, obviously, but an original old map that actually has the phrase "Here be dragons" on it. And as far as I know, and as far as other scholars are aware, that the phrase "Here be dragons" I'm not sure where it first appeared. No one quite knows, but it was popularized, we think, by Dorothy L. Sayers, the novelist, who had a character mention the phrase. It does appear, we think, on a globe from the 15th century, but not on a map.
It's very interesting when you talked earlier about the Mappa Mundi having Jerusalem in the center of the world. And I think about maps I saw in the United States as a kid. And if they were a flat wall map, of course, North America was always front and center, and you had Asia sort of split down the middle. I would imagine maybe the maps that you saw on the wall in your classrooms had Europe in the center and everything else was split. They do reflect how we see our place in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no such thing as a sort of, as an objective, true map. And the whole idea of maps, since maps began very much, with the possible exception, one could argue, of the first sort of ancient Greek maps, which were based perhaps more with a true scholarly quest. They were almost all, through history, construct, an axe to grind, or if that sounds too malicious, then a kind of an angle, a reason for being. Now, this could be because you wanted to, trade, and you wanted to get rich by finding gold in some foreign land, and then these maps would be very secretive, and you might put in some incorrect information to put people off the scent. There were certainly many cases through history where it was prohibited to kind of print and reproduce maps. And these were largely sponsored by people in power.
You know what, Simon, let me jump in. We need to take a quick break here. We will come back to this in a moment. My guest is author Simon Garfield. His new book is called On the Map, A Mind-Exploring Exploration of the World, of the Way the World Looks. We'll be back in just a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Simon Garfield. His new book is called On the Map, a mind-expanding exploration of the way the world looks. And if you go online now to keranews.org, you can find a link to a Wall Street Journal article Simon wrote a couple of weeks ago called The End of the Map. Very interesting, and we will talk about the contents of that in a few minutes. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. And Simon, before the break, you were talking about the fact that try as we might think we do, there's almost no such thing as a fully neutral map.
Yes, exactly. Because, you know, the early maps and maps now really are written very much with an angle. So it could be, you know, then it was perhaps a landowner wanting to sort of impress people how much land they owned, and perhaps, you know, enlarging it a little bit, or maybe for tax reasons they might a little bit. You know, now we have maps that, well, we get them on our sort of computers, and they're sort of free, but of course there's some advertising involved, and, you know, we'll soon find that the more we walk around with our phones on our maps, our maps on our phones, that, you know, we'll have little adverts at par with a particular shop trying to sell us something. So I will talk, I hope, I'm sure, because I always enjoy talking about the disaster of Apple Maps. So we kind of have all of that as well to come. But through history, you know, I always used to think, well, that if you had a map, it was somehow more accurate than piece of writing, or, you know, a sort of biographical account of what it was like to sort of see a land and be there. But that's actually, you know, through history that's not the case. Often it was a case of people trying to get things wrong on purpose, but often it was just making kind of, you know, simple human errors. And these on maps obviously can be quite fatal things.
And, you know, if you think about, you know, there's been so much criticism of the new Apple Maps and how it doesn't work as well as the Google platform they were using before. What it takes to get a map really right is just vast amounts of information, some of which won't actually make it onto the map, but which is important for understanding and gaining perspective.
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly right. I mean, you know, each map builds on the last, and in a way, that principle sort of explains why errors on maps get repeated, you know, time after time. I always think that you know, when you gather kind of huge amounts of information, all you can do is rely on people who have gone before. So you know, when Columbus and the people on his voyage were writing their own map there. They were purely adding to what had gone before, and that's sort of the case, you know, now as well. I mean, we're in the position, really, for the first time in our lives, or this has been the case for, I guess, a few years now, to sort of add to maps that help other people. It's hugely expensive to produce and reprint through the one technology. If we see that there's a new small road opening up or a new coffee bar that we like, we have the tool. It's taking too long to master them, to just go online and add to some, you know, open source existing maps that we know about, and we add our local knowledge to them. And that's a great and a novel thing. You know, I think the book is about, because I realize that we have reached a kind of tidal wave of change with digital maps. Computer maps, we have maps in our cars, obviously, our GPS, and we have maps on our phones. And this has been clearly the biggest sort of cartographical change, not only in our generation. And so, you know, hugely important. And they're both fantastic things. You know, these are wonderful things because by and large they are free, by and large they are accurate, and we find it far easier to get to A to B, and they're great tools. But we also lose a lot, and what we lose is things like perhaps the ability to, you know, to read a map, to kind of open an old-fashioned paper map. Used to be, you know, the thing that one did. You went on a hike, you took your map. Now a new generation is going out there, and they think they can just get by with their GPS, and they think they don't really have to, you know how to read a map. Obviously, what they find is that GPS fails, or the batteries run out on their phone, or whatever it is, and then the the rescue teams are called in. And I kind of happen to know, because I've talked to some of these guys, you know, that the mountain rescue people in places reasonably near me in Scotland and Wales, they think that that maps on phones are the worst things ever. So they're kind of, you know, the pros and cons, and that was really the idea of the book, just to try and kind of evaluate where we are and where or not. By not really now being able to buy paper, or we can still buy them, but they're not on sale in the way they were. They're not as important to our lives as they were, as they once were. And to really question whether or not we are sort of aware of what we're losing. And I think, you know, above all of that, I think what we're losing is the ability to kind of tell our history through maps. You know, I pick on a lot of maps, individual little maps that contain great nuggets of history and great nuggets of our past, but simply won't show up on our mobile phones.
Why, Simon, do we have two entire continents named after a guy who you describe as a skilled but minor Florentine navigator?
Yeah, the reason for that is sort of, the reason for that is sort of extraordinary, really. What happened was that, you know, with absolutely good intent, a man brought in Valsemora drew up a huge and glorious map in 1507, the beginning of the 16th century. We were already beginning to think, oddly enough, that we knew pretty much all there was to know of the world. And on his map, which is at the Library of Congress now, and I urge all listeners to go and see it if you're next in Washington, is a thin sliver of land on the very bottom left of the map, which is called America. And he called it America, whereas he was kind of very proud about this and actually explained why he was doing it. And he called it after a man called Amerigo Vespucci. Now, we all think, you look at this thing and you think, well, perhaps we don't think this because we're so used to, you know, being in America, calling it America, you kind of think, well, why didn't he call it Columbus? We all know that Columbus got there first. The reason is because of misinformation. So basically there were some letters going around, and some written by Vespucci himself, which sort of claimed that he got there first. Now, again, it's unclear whether or not this was a deliberate act of maliciousness, or whether it was sort of simple misdating and misremembering. But ultimately, by the time that the name America appeared on this map and then was copied on smaller maps all over the world, America it is.
I love that story because it speaks to the idea that, you know, sometimes mistakes get codified and they become reality.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, we talked about that, you know, the whole naming of America. But the other classic example that I love, which I talk about in the book, is when people thought that California was an island. what's even more odd about it, in around 1600, it appeared on maps for the first time very much as part of the mainland. And it was clear that, people were sort of happy to have it there. And it looked like, a beautiful and attractive place. About 50 years sort of after it first appeared in the map, so we're looking about 1650s now, it began to float free. And it appeared that you could sail all around it, that you wouldn't hit, Nevada, but you could actually go all the way around California. And it appeared on maps like this up until 1865 on a Japanese map. Now, it wasn't an island, but I think the Library of Congress has, well over 200 maps, which 200 separate maps, which show California as an island, and they're very fine maps as well. And you kind of think, well, how could this have happened? Because people must have tried to sail around it. But the reason is very much the same reason that mistakes get repeated in sort of in school essays. And I like to think of kind of early maps as sort of the Wikipedia era of their day often. So, you can have a mistake on Wikipedia, and until someone corrects it, then that mistake we did in 1000 school essays. And the same with this, the same with California as an island, which is one of the great and oddest. And it must be said, if you look at the maps online, sort of most beautiful map errors.
Well, I guess in some ways it makes sense if you think about Baja California. Maybe people just assume that it continued that way all the way up north.
Yeah, I suppose, that might have been it as well. But actually what happened was that, there was sort of any thinking, but I think it was just someone getting it kind of wrong. Maybe as a result, these things happen as a result of any amount of human error. Who was to say that the first one didn't happen when people first began to drink too much Californian wine?
You know what's funny, though, Simon? In some ways, it also reflects what we all do, which is if you're driving somewhere and the GPS gives you instructions that don't make sense, or you have a paper map that is outdated, somehow you keep looking at that device or that document and thinking, I must be in the wrong place. There's no chance that the map or the device has it wrong. It's got to be that I've made a mistake.
Yeah, I shouldn't admit this on air, of course, but I've driven places where, as you say, you kind of know to be kind of, wrong or strange or whatever, and it's a similar name or the same kind of name, but in a different part of the country or the the continent, even, you set your thing out. Actually, obviously, if the misdirections are big enough, the chances are you won't travel 200 miles out of your way, but you might travel 5 or 10 miles out of your way. And as you say, there's a sort of feeling that the map can only be right, and that we've got it wrong. And I mean, so here we are now. I finally get my chance to talk about Apple Maps. But I mean, the reason people were so outraged by Apple Maps, and why it was such an embarrassment for the car company, and why no one could really understand how Apple got it so wrong, because here we are, the biggest sort of tech company in the world. You kind of think, well, they wouldn't have done this if Steve Jobs had been alive. But last September, they released their own brand of maps that were, for want of a better word, really hopeless. And people couldn't believe how bad they were. They couldn't believe that there were sort of airports, sort of 5 miles from where they were. And my friend sort of upgraded his phone. He found that a fishmonger that should have been a mile away had somehow on the map move to his back garden. And, you know, it's a sort of you can't understand. But as you said at the beginning, we rely on, we rely on the accuracy of what has gone before and the huge amount of work that goes into it to get these things right. And Google Maps, which, you know, goodness knows has its own career ethics, you realize actually compared to Apple Maps how good they are and also how much work they put into expanding the map and how much personal kind of footwork, and or they go around in cars, obviously. Now, obviously, they also go around in planes, and they go around on spam. And what Apple tried to do was sort of do this on the cheap. And they're mutable for the sort of navigation that we expect.
We've talked about maps and their function in getting you from point A to point B, or sort of documenting political boundaries, but they have also been used down through the years as tools for figuring things out. Tell us a little bit about John Snow and the really miraculous ghost map of London in the cholera outbreak.
Yeah, a fantastic tale, really. I mean, we all have a picture of sort of Victorian London, don't we? You know, from those great BBC dramas and from Sherlock Holmes and kind of all of that, you know. And it all sort of melds into one. There's a lot of fog, there's a lot of poverty, there's a lot of disease. And, you know, there's a word for it, which is Dickensian. Mm-hmm. And John Snow lived through these times. He was a general practitioner. He dealt with sort of patients with all sorts of maladies. And he realized that the recent cholera outbreak, which had hit Soho, which anyone who's been to London, I'm sure, would have been to Soho. It's sort of a Leicester Square, Piccadilly Circus, bit of London.
You know, Simon, I'm going to jump in one more time. We need to take another break. We'll finish the story in a moment. My guest is author Simon Garfield. His brand new book is called On the Map, a mind-expanding exploration of the way the world looks. If you go to keranews.org, you can find a link to Simon's recent article in the Wall Street Journal. We'll come back to our conversation in a couple of minutes, and we invite you to join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Simon Garfield. His new book is called On the Map, a mind-expanding exploration of the way the world looks. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. And Simon, before the break, you were starting to tell us about John Snow, this general practitioner working in London and living through a really horrific urban cholera outbreak.
Exactly. So I've set the scene. We're in Dickensian land, and there's lots of fog, and there's lots of disease. And the worst disease, this is in the 1854, was cholera. We'd had cholera before in London, but this was the worst one. And people were just, you know, I mean, literally dropping like flies. Now, John Snow, a very brave physician, he didn't believe the big theory about cholera, but most people, including those in charge at the Board of Health, felt that cholera was airborne. Now, he didn't believe this, and he thought, well, there must be some other cause. And what he did, just by walking around London, was track on a map precisely where people had died. And he found that in a particular area in Soho called Broad Street, there had been many more deaths. And there's a fantastic map that he drew of slabs of houses where people had died. And in this one...
Are you with us, Simon? Okay, we seem to have a little bit of dropout. We are working on a Skype line. Simon Garfield is in a rather remote part of Wales today. And we are going to get him back on the line and bring him back to you in just a moment. My guest this hour is the author Simon Garfield. His new book is called On the Map, a mind-expanding exploration of the way the world looks. We've had Simon on the show before talking about his previous book, Just My Type, a book about fonts. Always an interesting view of history and micro-history. Garfield himself has said he became interested in studying maps as a child when he collected maps of the London Underground. Again, our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We do apologize for our technical difficulties today, the sound quality throughout the hour. Sometimes you have a computer line and things just don't go exactly as planned. We are bringing you Simon Garfield in just a moment. It looks like we've got him close to being back on the line with us here in a minute. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We do have author Simon Garfield, author of On the Map, back on the phone with us. Simon, welcome back. I apologize for our technical difficulties to both you and to our audience, but I'm so glad that we have you back on the line.
Well, listen, I'm happy to be back as well. I'm just sorry I'm not closer to you on the... On the real map, but I'm not sure how much of that you actually got before we lost each other.
I think we sort of left off, and you started to drop out when you talked about Dr. Jon Snow walking the streets of London and discovering particular areas where there had been a very large number of cholera deaths.
Exactly, and he kind of, you know, his big theory was that cholera wasn't airborne, it was waterborne. And he found that all these deaths in a particular area of Soho were caused not by a miasma, as it was called in the air, not, you know, how one might catch the flu, for instance, but because everyone within this area had drawn their water from one particular pump. Now, he got to this conclusion before he actually drew the map, but he used the map to demonstrate to the authorities that his theory about how cholera was so infectious was correct, and as a result of which the government enacted new laws which changed not only in England but also in Europe the way we treat water and the way we treat sanitation and the way we protect ourselves.
Let's talk about treasure maps. I don't know if kids still read it today. Maybe your generation, and I think we're of the same generation, maybe we were the last ones to read Treasure Island, but it was such a great story. And it seems as if, I don't know, did Stevenson inspire other people to make real treasure maps, or did they really exist in history?
Well, they did exist before he invented them, but he was the one to sort of form that great treasure map in our mind, you know, that sort of slightly leathery, worn, brown, curling at the edges map. And his big thing was, you know, X marks the spot. I don't think before he came along with Treasure Island that anyone had used that phrase before, and certainly, you know, they didn't mark treasure so much with a significant X. They might have used, other simply, they may have used an X, of course, but in our imaginations, the Treasure Island treasure map, you know, hidden in a chest, and it's sort of handed down from one great sailor to another, one captain to another, is, you know, it's a fantastic and, as you say, lasting image. I mean, an interesting point about that is that the original map that he drew, that he sent to his publishers in London, got lost, and this was a map that he was drawing as he wrote the book, he said that when he tried to reproduce the map again, having written the book, and his publishers wanted, his sketch of the island for the first edition, he felt he really couldn't draw it. He felt it was a very sort of inspiring thing originally, and it was a one-off, and he had great trouble in reproducing it, and he said it wasn't anything like as good. But, you say, well, it's in your head, and you're right, it's in my head as well, and I think that's sort of the wonderful thing about so much kids' literature, and I think that tour edition upholds now. Perhaps it's not sort of as great as it was, but the maps that we sort of remember, either real maps that were drawn by Tolkien and others, for The Hobbit and elsewhere in Middle-earth, and all maps that we just sort of imagine were there, because the description in children's literature is so strong and sears itself into our brain that they never leave us. In the book, I kind of have a thought that actually the way that this tradition is carried on, the way that the kids learn about maps is not so much now through classic literature and books, but actually it's more through computer games. Mm. So many of the leading best-selling computer games rely on mythical islands and mythical worlds and creations in our heads, and the maps that you have to follow to get around a particular imaginary land are kind of all important. And I think very much that's the way that if we are losing our ability because of digital maps to imagine space, and if we're losing our ability of spatial awareness and to imagine things a long way ahead, then hopefully things like computer games are kind of bringing that back a little bit and kind of helping to remedy that loss.
It's funny that in some of those games, the presence of a map, you sort of pull out of the screen that you're on where you're seeing things in first-person sort of perspective, and then you pull back to the map. The map makes this imaginary place seem more real in a way.
I think that's right. The more the brain works, the more we learn, and that really goes for everything. But the more we... The more we have to remember it, the difference is, if someone says something to you, it may go in a bit, but if you write it down, or if you somehow then imprint it, within your brain memory, it has a much sort of longer lasting impression. I mean, my real concern about digital maps, I think, and I use a GPS in my car, especially if I'm alone and if I'm traveling to a new place. But the problem with that, and also to a lesser extent computer maps, is we don't really have an idea of what lies ahead and what is around us. And we can travel from one part of the country to another and not really know how we got there, not know any of the places that we saw, because we spent our entire time looking either at a little glass box on our windscreen, all at maps in our hands, and I'm concerned about that, as much as the sort of the greater accuracy and the greater speed that these maps provide.
I would tend to agree with you there. The one thing that I find is exciting is technology that would allow you to get a sort of street eye view of the studio where I'm sitting, and for me to get a view of the place where you're sitting right now, even though you and I are thousands of miles apart.
Oh, I agree. I don't want to be a naysayer for new mapping and new technology and some wonderful things. And, I say in the book that without GPS, the world would sort of would go dark. It's not just a case that we wouldn't be able to find our directions to our friends or the local movie theater, but it's more the case that I say that if you turn off GPS, it would be like turning off the world's sort of electricity and gas supplies all at once. So much depends on it. You know, traffic would stop, planes wouldn't fly, and all of that. So it's a wonderful thing, and I make full advantage of mapping apps on my phone as much as I can. But I'm sort of concerned that, as I said, we may lose an ability to read a map, which I think is a valuable and a wonderful thing. I think I know from talking to map makers, for instance, the Great British Ordnance Survey and the great sort of map survey that mapped France in the 18th century, those maps now don't sell. It's because we can, why spend, $15 on a map when you can get it for free? And that's sort of my kids' attitude very much. I suppose you could argue the same for kind of newspapers, And I think that's a great loss, because I think we lose a sense of, map making on our computers, or map reading on our computers and our phones, gives us a sense that we're always at the center of the world. There's this little flashing dot of where we are. We enable location on our computers and on our phones, and we're always at the middle of the world. But we know traditionally that the world actually is a bigger place, so we're not actually at the middle of the world at all.
The new book by author Simon Garfield is called On the Map, a mind-expanding exploration of the way the world looks. Simon, it's always a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Great. Well, I really enjoyed it, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can download the podcast free at kera.org/think, and we welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.